Mr. Sally Realto.
Then we went to Macrahanish again, where we went on a rocket projectile course. It seems ludicrous that a biplane carried something so modern as rockets. There were four rails on either wing, and the rockets were solid metal heads. I believe bow fighters and some of the bigger aircraft carried rockets which had explosive heads, but we never got that far on Swordfish. I do remember whilst carrying out this training on a way to the rocket ranges, when I had the CO John Lang as my observer, the engine suddenly stopped, and I had to look around pretty quickly for somewhere to land, and I eventually found a field about as big as a postage stamp, and with the greatest good luck, I suppose a little bit of skill, I managed to get it down and plunk on my brakes and stop within inches of a ditch. One can judge the size of this field by the fact that when the aircraft had been repaired in situ, they had to wait something like 2 months before there was sufficient wind over the ground to enable them to fly the aircraft out, despite the fact that they had stripped it of every excrescence and weight in order to make it as light as possible. But they did eventually get it out when the wind was sufficiently high to allow it to fly off. Then we were off to Ballykelly in Northern Ireland, where we did a Western Approaches course, and this was exercises with destroyers and escorts and frigates on convoy escort work. Then back to Battler again. And I think I've misled you in my original thing about the Battler, because it was on this trip with the Battler that we went down to Gibraltar. So I'm sorry, that when I said we went to Gibraltar with the Battler on the first occasion, we were working up on that occasion. It was this occasion that, this was the 4th of May, 43, to the 28th of June, 43, that we spent on Battler, that we went down to Gibraltar. Back again, we were offloaded at Eglinton in Northern Ireland for 3 or 4 weeks. Back on Battler again for 3 or 4 weeks. Then we were off to RAF station at Ayr for 2 or 3 months. And all this time we were flying, working up, practicing torpedo attacks. Torpedoes were out by that time. Anti-submarine attacks. And, of course, coordination with fighters. Because about this time, the squadron was converted into a composite squadron composing of 6 or 8 Swordfish and 6 Hurricanes. Now, the reason for this was that the Germans had changed their U-boat tactics. Instead of diving whenever an aircraft was attacking the U-boat, they elected to stay on the surface and fight back with the guns on the upper deck of the U-boat. So we had the fighters aboard, of course, to deal with the shadowing condors and any air attacks there might be, but also so that if a U-boat was sighted, the Swordfish could call up the fighter boys who came down and strafed the deck. And the Swordfish followed in and dropped its depth charges after the deck had been cleared. Now, we had an interesting month or so on board HMS Argus, which was one of the oldest aircraft carriers about at that time. Most peculiar ship, because the bridge was in the middle of the flight deck, and when they were steaming along, the bridge was an excrescence in the middle of the flight deck. When we needed to fly, the bridge came down on a lift so that we had a flat platform on which to fly off. Hardly believe it, can you? Did you know that?
No.
And our object of being on the Argus was to test a new bomb that had been invented by one of the backroom boys called a buoyancy bomb. The object of this bomb was that it was dropped not to hit the ship, but to be dropped short of the ship so that the bomb went under the water in a parabola and came up under the keel of the ship, which it was reckoned to be not as well protected as the side or the upper deck. Now, we did lots of these tests with buoyancy bombs, and we got quite a few hits. But I never heard anything more that it was ever developed again. From Argus, we were transferred to HMS Chaser, another American escort carrier. And again, we did another trip to Gibraltar, two-thirds of the way across the Atlantic and down, etc., in Chaser. From Chaser, we were put ashore at Eglinton, and we're now in December 1943. And I must tell you a little anecdote about our Christmas at Eglinton in Northern Ireland. By this time, we were pretty confirmed drinkers, and we had a great Christmas party at Eglinton. At the end of one of these parties, I don't know if you're a drinking man, I don't suppose you ever drank as much as we did in those days, but at the end of the party, one's always looking for something to eat. One of these chaps said, "By God, I could do a steak." And one of the chaps, who was a little bit more drunk than the others, said, "Well, I've had enough. I'm going back to the cabin," which was a Nissen hut, incidentally, but always called a cabin. When he got outside the mess, there, standing in front of the mess, the wardroom, was a cow. And in his befuddled state, he thought, "Ah, cow, steak. We've got something here." So he went back to his cabin, got his revolver, came back and shot the cow. Then he went into the wardroom and said, "I've got your steaks, boys. It's all out here." And of course, some of the chaps were a bit more sober than the others and thought, "My God, what the hell are we going to do now? He shot a cow." Then some bloke, a bit brighter than the others, said, "I know the solution." And we were living in a little place called Eglinton, a little village. He went down to the village, found the butcher's shop, knocked up the butcher at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and said, "Do you want a dead cow?" And after there'd been a little bit of explanation, the butcher came up with his knives, cut the cow up, gave us the steaks, took it all away, cleaned it all up, and there wasn't a sign of it the next morning. By this time, the bloke who shot the cow had wandered back to his billet and, gone to bed again. So next morning at breakfast, he was feeling pretty sorry for himself, came to the mess expecting to find a gory mess there. Absolutely nothing, all cleared up. He went into the wardroom and said, "Here, what happened to that cow last night?" And everybody said, "What cow?" And for 2 or 3 days, he didn't know what was happening. He was rather worried that he had the beginnings of DTs. However, that's a little aside, a little anecdote. We then went on to HMS Nairana. And this, at long last, was the ship on which we spent the next 18 months to 2 years. Can I stop there? The captain of the ship was Captain R.M.T.T. Taylor at that time. Later to become a commodore. Very gentle, nice, gentlemanly sort of a chap. He was succeeded by Captain Surtees, DSO, who was a bachelor, a salt horse, completely ignorant of flying, and a very difficult man to serve under, in that his ignorance of flying led him into believing that we could fly at any time in any weather. He also had a weak commander flying who was not prepared to stand up to him which meant that Surtees, on several occasions, demanded flying to take place when it was absolutely impossible to fly. There was one occasion when he ordered a patrol to take off when we were on the way to Russia, when the weather was absolutely dreadful. There was a 60-knot wind, a snowstorm, the ship was tossing and turning like a corkscrew, but he was adamant that he wanted a swordfish flown off, despite the fact that no U-boat could have survived anywhere near the surface in the conditions in which we were sailing. The CO of the squadron by this time was a chap by the name of Val Jones. Delightful personality, delightful chap, and he stood up to the captain and said, "It's impossible to fly in this weather, and I am not going to send any of my crews up in it." And the captain said, "I order you to," in which case Val said, "I will go myself," and Val was an observer, and I was his pilot, and I shall never forget his face when he came down to the crew room and said, "Bob," he said, "I've had an up and down with the captain. I refuse to send any of the crews, but I've told him that if he insists that someone's got to go, that I will go. Will you take me?" So what could I say? But yes, he was a delightful chap. And we took off. Oh, and it was pitch black, incidentally, because there was very, very little daylight on our Arctic convoy runs. We darkened ship about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We took off in the black, the sleet, the snow, gales, ship corkscrewing like fury. And we were intended to fly about 10 or 12 miles ahead of the convoy and crisscross across the path of the convoy to deal with any U-boats that may be in the path of the convoy. Well, we had been flying about half an hour trying to get 10 or 12 miles ahead of the convoy, when all of a sudden my engine stopped, kaput, just like that. Val shouted, "Mayday, mayday, mayday." I switched on. Look, the first thing I did, of course, was jettison everything, because by jettisoning, one got a little bit extra height, gave you a few extra seconds to cope with the emergency. Now, depth charges, one could jettison safe. No problem about that. But flares, when you jettison them, there was no safety mechanism on them. They went off. So, pulled the jettison switch, everything went, and the flares lit. And despite the fact that we had been ploughing along for half an hour trying to get ahead of the convoy, when the flares went off, we were still over the top of the convoy. We had made no progress, simply because of the howling wind that had been coming in our face all the time. And by this time, of course, the dear old swordfish, I think you'll see in all the books that their cruising speed was 120 knots. By this time, they'd fitted us up with so many gadgets. We had a damn great pregnant bulge between the wings, between the undercarriage, which was the radar. We had radio altimeters, we had rocket projectiles. We even had to have a rocket-assisted takeoff to get off the deck in some cases. This was due to two factors. One, escort carriers were only about 400 feet long anyway, which wasn't a great deal of length to get off if you hadn't got much wind. And secondly, we had so much weight aboard that the cruising speed of the dear old swordfish was something like 80 knots if you were lucky. And the stalling speed with all the weight aboard was about something like 65. So there wasn't a great deal of a safety margin. However, there we were, over the convoy, no engine. Luckily, the propeller was still windmilling. And I was switching switches, turning knobs, doing everything I could think of to start it again, when all of a sudden the engine cut in again. I think possibly what had happened was that the carburetor had frozen up, and that by reducing height, obviously when the engine cut, it had possibly de-iced again. And the engine started, and I had no difficulty getting back to the convoy because I was over it, despite the fact that I'd been flying away for it for half an hour. And I then had the job, of course, of getting back on board, the problem being that the ship was corkscrewing, which meant that as you came in over the round down to make your landing, very often the round down disappeared from view, because as you were coming in, it corkscrewed away like that. So you had to go round and round. I've forgotten how many times I went round, but it was quite a considerable number. And I know I felt pig sick by the time I did get down, because it was a very, very frightening experience. I thought my time had come. Now, would you like me to talk about Group Captain Walker and the SO and three bars at this stage?
Yes, please.
One of the trips we did in Nairana was with Captain Walker and the SO and three bars, with his hunter group of frigates, and we did this out in the Atlantic. We we were ploughing around the Atlantic, and obviously with hindsight now and knowing about Ultra, Captain Walker had a very good idea where the wolf packs were in the ocean. And instead of avoiding them, as we did when we were doing convoy work, he obviously led us on to a situation where he knew there were some U-boats. And in this particular operation, whilst the aircraft from Nairana didn't sink any U-boats, Captain Walker and his group sank six or seven in about 3 or 4 days. He was very grateful to Nairana and 835 Squadron, because he said that the Swordfish aircraft, with their radar, kept the submarines or the U-boats below the surface, the U-boats being able to pick up the transmissions from our radar from some distance, and as soon as they knew an aircraft was approaching, they ducked under the water. Once they were ducked under the water, their speed was halved, if not more. And this gave the frigates of Walker's escort group chance to tackle them and sink them. The other reason he was grateful to us being there was that he regarded Nairana as an aircraft carrier being an excellent bait for the U-boats to congregate around. I don't want this to appear too disjointed, but I have jotted down some notes here of the impressions I got of our Russian runs. I think the first thing I've got to emphasise is the weather we had to contend with. At one stage, Nairana rolled 54 degrees from the vertical. Now, that is a very, very frightening experience, because it doesn't roll and then roll back. It rolls over to 54 degrees and appears to stay there for about 10 or 12 seconds, trying to make up its mind whether to roll back onto the upright position or to roll further and capsize completely. But it was a very frightening experience. The winds, the cold, the darkness were altogether, I think, more frightening than the Germans. And it must be remembered at the time that we were going to Russia in these convoys, there was only about 2 hours daylight a day, because we used to darken ship at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the rest of the day until about midday the next day was darkness. I must say that once we got to Vanganga Bay near Murmansk, the Russians looked after us very well. They came aboard with their North Russian Red Fleet concert party and gave us the most highest standard of concert that really I've ever seen. I think someone said they came from the Moscow Opera House, but they were absolutely first class. The Russian pilot, and I mean here a ship's pilot, not an aircraft pilot, who we took aboard in Vanganga Bay to guide the ship into the bay, came down to the wardroom after he'd safely got us anchored, and we entertained him to dinner. Now, I particularly watched this chap who was opposite me on the dining table, and I counted that he ate, with his dinner, 12 white bread rolls, and I came to the conclusion that he'd never seen white bread in his life before. In addition to this, of course, we were filling him with vodka, and every drink he had was a triple. But the only effect it seemed to have on him was that he broke out into a clammy sweat. But apart from that, the vodka had appeared to have very little effect on him. One small point which was amusing was that the only language in which we could speak to him was German as a common language. One other problem which we experienced on Russian convoys was the wild swing of magnetic compasses. Because of the proximity of Bear Island and the magnetic properties thereto, which resulted in the magnetic compasses swinging anything from 90 to 100 degrees, so one had to steer somewhere in between. Of course, one was assisted by the fact that one had a gyro compass, which one set as good as one can before you took off, but then the magnetic compass was affected by all the steel in the ship, and you were only really going by guess and by God. And it's got to be remembered that the gyros recessed 2 or 3 degrees every half an hour. So one could more or less rule out dead reckoning as a navigating aid, and we had really to rely on our radar sets. When we went to Russia on the first convoy, JW-61, we had an accompanying aircraft carrier called Windex. Now, the theory was that HMS Narana, with 835 aboard, which was a very, very experienced squadron, would do all the night work and foul weather work because they had the experienced pilots, and Windex would do the fair weather flying to give us a rest when there was fair weather. The only snag about this, of course, was the fact that there was no fair weather, and consequently the poor Narana crews were stretched to the limit. One interesting episode on one of our trips up to Russia was when we were being shadowed at night by a German reconnaissance plane, and none of our fighters were capable of flying at night, certainly not of landing on at night, and some bright herb in the FDO said, why not send up a swordfish? They won't know the difference, and it might frighten them away. And you can guess who was sent up. That was me, with Dave Newbury as my observer. He was given a Tommy gun. World War I stuff, isn't it? Fighting over the sand. And we were vectored onto this shadowing aircraft. Well, luckily, what they thought might happen did happen, and obviously the shadowing aircraft picked up the my aircraft coming towards them, didn't realise it was only a swordfish, thought it was a fighter aircraft, and pushed off. So, mission accomplished, as it were. One little interesting anecdote about the time when the ship rolled 54 degrees. concerns a chap called Methven, who was the ship's gunnery officer, a dedicated toper, who was in the wardroom drinking, and in order that he should carry on his drinking without too much interruption, he lashed himself to a stanchion so that he wasn't thrown over when the ship rolled its 54 degrees. Anyway, after the first trip to Russia, the flag officer carrier training, Lister, I think his name was, came aboard to congratulate 835 Squadron because we were the first squadron to go to Russia escorting a convoy who did not lose a ship. In fact, in all the existence of 835 Squadron, on all our Atlantic escort control convoys and all our Russian escort convoys, we lost only one merchant ship, and that was a straggler. So we did what we were supposed to do. We protected the convoy and got the convoy through. Can I say something now about the flying gear we had?
Please.
In these conditions. By the time we did our second trip to Russia, someone had invented immersion suits, which were waterproof and gave you a little more chance if you came down in the sea. If you did not have an immersion suit and you came down in the sea, your life expectancy was 2 to 3 minutes before you died of hypothermia and exposure. But they introduced these immersion suits, which seemed to do the trick. The only problem was that they all seemed to be designed for men of 6 foot 6 inches high, tall. But nevertheless, we struggled into them and wore them because we knew, A, they kept us warm, and B, if we had to go into the sea, we would have an hour or so to survive, giving someone a chance to pick us up. In addition to that, we had chemically warmed gloves and chemically warmed boot inserts. Now, this consisted of a glove with a pocket in the palm of the glove in which there were some chemicals. And before you took off, you had to pour water into these chemicals, and the combination of the water and the chemicals created warmth for your hands, theoretically, and ditto with your feet, with the inserts in your boots. You put water in them and the chemical reaction produced warmth. As far as I could see, the damn things are, they were too hot. You were burning yourself, or they didn't work at all. There was no in between, but, you know, it was something they were trying to do. I mean, in these days, they've got electrically heated suits, etc. Now, the next convoy we went up was J-162. And on this trip, the sanity of the captain of Narana was questioned.